you like what you're hearing, put your money where your media is by subscribing to independent podcasts like this one. Go to lauraflanders.org/membership. And thanks. Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and this is the Laura Flanders Show, the TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real models of shifting power from the worlds of arts, entrepreneurship, politics, and activism. From No I Won't to Yes We Will, this week on the Laura Flanders Show, it's official, a record-breaking number of women have won seats in Congress. Over 100 women, more women than ever, were voted into Congress this season, including New Mexico's Deb Haaland and Charisse Davids, the Congress's first two Native American women. Davids is the first out lesbian Native American, too. As anticipated, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a socialist Democrat, is now Congresswoman from New York. With the midterms behind us, we're looking at the roots of struggle for good governance in these United States of ours, and hear from, among others, historian Jeff Biggers, Dream Defender Philip Agnew, and Niaz Dori, Executive Director of the National Family Farm Coalition. All that, plus women suffrage fighters Susan B. Anthony and the voice of people's historian Howard Zinn. It's election week on the Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome.
Women had long been denied the right to vote, even after helping to win voting rights for blacks with the passage of the 15th Amendment. In November 1872, Susan B. Anthony was one of 14 women who defied the law to cast a ballot in the presidential election. Anthony was arrested for, quote, knowingly voting without having a lawful right to vote, unquote, and was found guilty.
Has the prisoner anything to say why sentence shall not be pronounced?
Yes, Your Honor, I have many things to say. Your denial of my citizens' right to vote is the denial of my right of consent as one of the governed, the denial of my right of representation as one of the taxed, the denial of my right to a trial by a jury of my peers as an offender against law. Therefore, the denial of my sacred right to life, liberty, property.
The court cannot allow the prisoner to go on.
But Your Honor will not deny me this one and only poor privilege of protest against this high-handed outrage upon my citizens' rights.
The sentence of the court is that you pay a fine of $100 and the costs of the prosecution.
May it please Your Honor, I will never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty. All the stock in trade I possess is a debt of $10,000 incurred by publishing my paper, The Revolution, the sole object of which was to educate all women to do precisely as I have done, rebel against your man-made, unjust, unconstitutional forms of law, which tax, fine, imprison, and hang women while denying them the right of representation in the government. And I will work on with might and main to pay every dollar of that honest debt, but not a penny shall go to this unjust claim. And I shall earnestly and persistently continue to urge all women to the practical recognition of the old revolutionary maxim, resistance to tyranny is obedience to God.
That was an excerpt from The People Speak, based on Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. Resistance. The dictionary defines it as the refusal to accept or comply, an attempt to prevent something by action or argument. United States founding father and slaveholder Thomas Jefferson believed that resistance was nourishing to the body politic. As he wrote to James Madison, a little rebellion was medicine, necessary for the sound health of government. The U.S. has seen lots of rebellions. I had a chance to talk about some of those earlier this year with author-activist Jeff Biggers. What does democracy look like? Resistance, says Biggers. And it's the story he tells in his latest book, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Welcome back, Jeff. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura. Really
so, I mean, you say this was kind of an act of love for your family and your son. Take us back to that moment. Because you've been writing about how hugely powerful some forces in this country are. And then you come out with, well, maybe we can beat them.
You know, my son looked at me. This was right after President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords. And of course, the only country in the world to do so. And my son had often heard me speak about climate change and whatnot, and I think he was expecting some sort of lecture. And he came to me and he said, "Dad, is there any hope for us now?" Meaning his generation. And you know, when a 12-year-old looks at you and says that, you just can't be glib. You can't just say, "Oh, yeah, you know, just be nice to your friends and recycle your pop bottle."
Right.
You know, I had to really think, how am I going to respond to this? And I couldn't just simply say, yes, we can go do climate action and maybe there is hope. Because I think we are facing irreversible destruction to our environment right now. And we are in one of the darkest times of our history. And so I had to go back to our roots, to our beginnings. And, you know, Laura, as you say, this is my eighth book. I see myself almost as a cultural historian of the resistance. I've gone region by region looking how people have reclaimed their incredible stories and histories of resistance. And I felt I needed to do it on a national basis, going back not only to the American Revolution, but even before that.
So is there hope?
Oh, there's so much hope. You know, I looked at my son and I said, "I need to tell you a story about being in Washington in 1985. I was 21 years old, and we began to realize, you know, President Reagan at that period refused to put sanctions against our apartheid. In fact, he called Nelson Mandela a communist That's agent, right. And we allowed apartheid to go on, and there was just absolutely no interference here in the United States. And we felt that was wrong. We had to do something about it. Here, Mandela had been in prison more than I actually had been on this planet. And so we came down to Washington. I was here in New York City at Riverside Church. And we began to blockade the doors of the South African embassy day after, day in, day after. People from around the country. Over 400 days we had this sit-in. It was really one of the most amazing movements in our country for the Free South Africa movement. Once again, not to change what was happening there, but to change our own government's complicity to apartheid. And when I was in jail there in Washington, I was sitting with William Sloan Coffin, the great minister and civil rights activist and anti-war activist and someone who had actually fought through World War II. And he could see I was fidgety and I was saying, "Bill, this is ridiculous. We're not going to change anything. It's hopeless." And Bill sat me down on this concrete bench in Washington in the jail and he said, "Jeff, I'm going to tell you something I learned in 1961. He was one of the first white preachers to go down on the Freedom Rides. And he said, "There in Alabama, we were arrested, taken off, brutalized, put in jail. And he said, there, young African-American saw that he was being fidgety. And they sat him down and said, you know, hopelessness adapts, but hope resists." And I think that is the kind of spirit we have to approach today with the White House and President Trump.
Are the people in this book who were new to you? Did you discover new people? I certainly did as I was looking at it.
You know, I felt like I needed to tell stories of people beyond sort of the founding fathers, people who often we talk about these watershed moments, you know, the Boston Tea Party. And we forget, for example, the Boston Tea Party was very unpopular. That, in fact, Benjamin Franklin wrote a letter saying, you know, you really ought to pay for that tea that you threw into the water. And that, in fact, we it's, you know, resistance is in the eyes of the beholder and mainly in the eyes of the powerful. And so I had to go back to people we've often forgotten about, people who are fundamental to our country. For example, someone who's quite known to us, but not to most Americans. And that is the very writer who gave us the name the United States of America. And that was the great British author. He was an undocumented immigrant named Thomas Paine, someone who was a complete failure, twice went into debt, twice had his marriage break up, someone who couldn't even become a tax collector in England. He was such a failure. He gets on the boat. He barely survives. He gets off on a stretcher. And somehow in Philadelphia, he manages to start a magazine. And there in 1775, once again, this immigrant who came for the fiery reasons of independence that he had so much heard about, realized there was this colonial elite that was willing to be complicit and reconcile, almost like a democratic establishment in Congress.
Mm.
You know, and Paine pushed them. You know, he said, "Hey, are we all going to be working with this young movement in Philadelphia?" There was this incredible young movement of immigrants and merchants. And once again, he pointed out, "Hey, less than a third of the people in Philadelphia are native English speakers. Why are we talking about this English constitution?" And he went on, of course, to change the course of our nation with his common sense and, more importantly, his American crisis that forced us, in fact, to not only fight the revolution, but to seed this fundamental credo. Laura, and this is really the theme of my book, is that it's our patriotic duty to resist duplicitous authority when it attacks our democracy.
There's so many great stories in the book, and I could have you here talk about all of them. I love stories like this, but it also occurs to me that we do tell a story of resistance about this country that is sometimes overstated. Mm. And even just looking at that moment from 1776, the Declaration of Independence, we the people, to 86, when the actual Constitution gets written, and it's kind of different in its respect, in its treatment of freedom, becomes a lot more about freedom of yourself to have your property and not have it messed with. Do we sometimes overstate how much resistance spirit actually made it into our founding documents? And what happened in that decade to change things?
Right. You know, that's a great question. And immediately after the revolution, we immediately had rebellions in the back country because the Continental Congress met and began a taxation process that people in the rural areas thought was very unfair, that it was favoring the colonial elite, people who were in power. George Mason was one of our forgotten founders, who did the Virginia Declaration of 1775, and in fact, he gave us the happiness and the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Right. Our original original document was life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And of course, Mason changed that. Mason was one of three men who walked out of the Constitutional Convention and refused to sign because of many reasons. One, he said, hey, if we're not going to end slavery, we're not living up to the aspirations of what we've talked about. And two, he said, we're giving too much power to an aristocracy that is rising. And he felt even the giving the president the right to pardon, which we're seeing now with President Trump, was something that was going to be misused. He said, we're very close to an aristocracy or a monarchy. And so I think what you saw from the very beginning was the credo of resistance, once again, that Paine and many other people, Phyllis Wheatley, as you said, the wonderful African-American poet, and many other people, were saying that this credo of resistance is not just going to go away because we gained our independence, but in fact, we have seeded our resistance into the American quintessential American experience.
You eventually, much later on, quote Valerie Kaur from the Revolutionary Love Project, who talks about resistance alone will not deliver us. We must give birth, or we must birth a new nation. Naomi Klein, too, says resistance is not enough. What else do we need in addition to resistance, and where do you see that?
Right. I think that's very powerful, but I also feel like resistance is not a singular thing. Resistance is not just protest. It's not just registering people to vote. It's not just getting into the streets. It's not just going into the courts and challenging, you know, wrong decisions on immigration policy. Resistance is also an agency of renewal, as Thomas Paine said. It's you know, Paine said, we have it in our power to reinvent the world. And I think that's what I'm talking about when I talk about resistance is in the bigger context, that we have to reframe resistance as an agency of renewal. My last chapter speaks about cities of resistance. And what I mean by that is we have to move in the directions of regenerative cities like we're seeing across the world, of people who realize, hey, we can't just have carbon emissions. We can't just import 90% of our food. We can't just have these lights, you know, burning from coal and natural gas. So we have to begin to create a circular economy. We have to challenge elements of capitalism and move in the direction of a regenerative society, a circular society that actually is going to be sustainable.
Finally, well, you've brought us back to the environment, and I'm glad you did. While we have been resisting, lots of individuals, and Scott Pruitt from the EPA was one of the ones who got an awful lot of attention in the first part of this Trump administration, eventually resigned. Are we missing perhaps what's actually being done by some of these people? And have you been keeping an eye on what's actually going on at EPA? Do we focus too much on individuals?
You know, I think once again, it's a great point. We were kind of obsessed because Pruitt was almost a larger-than-life character with his personal scandals and his involvement with the natural gas companies and, of course, his Oklahoma background. Meanwhile, 67 major environmental regulations have been reversed. And I see that personally, of course, as a reporter in the coal fields. You know, the Clean Water Act, which was passed and forced under President Nixon, was one way we were able to at least stabilize and set certain restrictions on how close coal mining companies could dump their waste and heavy metals into our water. And still it wasn't enforced. You know, and we had been working and reporting on that for years. And now they've even removed that restriction that coal companies can dump directly into waterways. And we're talking, Laura, things like heavy metals like lead and selenium and arsenic, which are really poisoning and killing American citizens. And so, yes, we are really seeing some major damages, which I call almost irreversible damages. And the new EPA chief who's coming on, if he keeps the position, we're hearing that, in fact, he may want to transition out, is a former coal lobbyist who worked for probably the worst coal company in the country. You know, Bob Murray, Murray Energy, who was behind the Crandall Canyon disaster in Utah, who ran one of the worst coal mines in southern Illinois, where my family's from, who has who's led this industry in a state of continual lawlessness and violations. And that is the man who we've asked now to protect our environment. So I think we have to get beyond the personnel and really look at the policies themselves and in many sense resist these directly.
Long scope of history. Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Jeff, thank you so much. The book's out now. You can get more information at our website. Jeff Biggers, everyone.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another mountain. There are mountains and hillsides enough to climb. There are oceans and rivers enough to cross, enough to last till the end of time. What the world needs now is love, sweet.
That was What the World Needs Now, a rework by Jonathan Butler, featured on Close to You, his tribute album to Burt Bacharach. It's released on Mac Avenue. I'm Laura. This is The Laura Flanders Show. For 10 years, we've been at this, uplifting forward-looking people, defying and resisting the naysayers, showing up real strategies for shifting power from the few to the many. You can watch the show at our website and over the Indie Media Network's Free Speech TV, Link TV, and CUNY TV. Prefer to listen? The show airs on the Pacifica Radio Network, or simply subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Subscribers receive additional mini-casts, I'm just saying, including my weekly commentary. The latest is on racist vandalism at the African burial ground in New York City, on what is possibly the most well-policed block in the nation. Who did it? For more information and to become a sustaining member for as little as $2 a month or make a one-time donation, go to lauraflanders.org. Make that contribution your happy birthday message for this show. We couldn't have come this far without you. My next guest is Niaz Dori. As the National Family Farm Coalition's newly appointed executive director, she toured rural America covering 13,000 miles of heartland, visiting family farms, fisheries, and communities. Along the way, she found the struggles for everyday people in rural America and urban America are more similar than we've been led to believe. We caught up with Dori at the 2018 Northeast Sustainable Agriculture Working Group Conference in Philadelphia, just before the elections.
We set out in late spring on a two-month tour of primarily rural communities. And the purpose for the tour was for me, in my new role, to get to meet some of the members of the National Family Farm Coalition and to get reacquainted with those we work with at the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. We visited 67 communities. We traveled about 13,000 miles. This was really more about hearing what is happening in their lives and in their communities and with their businesses, because these are businesses. Whether we were in a fishing community or in a farming community, we learned that their main concerns are really centered around this corporate consolidation and concentration, their inability to be economically empowered because they're not getting paid the fair price. They can't even cover their cost of production. In many cases, they are what I call farming and fishing in the red. Before you even eat their tomato or their fishes hit the dock, they're already in debt. Well, we're told that rural communities are the enemy of urban communities, that they are the places where people who don't see everybody else's equal live, and they're the places where people are more closed-minded, and there is racism, and there is bigotry, and there is everything that makes us want to fear each other. And then they're told that in urban communities, they don't understand farmers, they don't understand rural communities, and they're a bunch of leftist, you know, socialist people who don't get the idea that rural communities are in trouble. And so this idea that these two parts of our society are separate, are so different from each other, is another way to keep us apart. And what I learned on this trip is that there are many in rural communities. Sure, we bumped into a few who we had some heated conversations about, but they were far and few in between. And for the most part, what we learned is that we're dealing with folks who have the same concern as our neighbors do anywhere, wherever we live, and they feel marginalized. We heard a lot of folks say nobody comes here, and we heard, for example, in Montana, that the presidential candidates for the 2016 elections on the Democratic side did not show up. The Clinton campaign decided they were just going to focus on urban in communities and not show up in many rural communities. And it wasn't because they didn't have support. They lost the support because they chose not to value them and not to come and visit with them. And so for me, it was really important to hear that and to experience that myself, as opposed to hear from, you know, third hand or some other source. Because here are people who invited us to their dinner tables, and or we talked with them around their trucks or on their fishing boats, and we were hearing from them views that I wasn't expecting to hear, because our current system tells me they are so closed-minded that I'm not going to hear things from them that I would hear from my more progressive, so-called progressive colleagues and friends. And yet, we did. We heard ideas from them, and we had a receptiveness, even though here I am, you know, an Iranian American, and I'm going into deep red states, and we didn't have any resistance to being there, and we were welcomed in most of those places. And I remember constantly the conversation I had with a fisherman who, at the end, he said, you know, we're open-minded people here, don't let them tell you otherwise. And so we experienced that quite a bit. And so I'm now challenging the notion that there is that much separation. It's not just like any other community where there are some who feel a certain way and others who don't. And when we paint rural communities with a broad brush, or when urban communities are painted with a broad brush, we end up hurting ourselves, and we end up diminishing our ability to organize across communities and across areas of interest. And so I just want to encourage those who have preconceived notions around what anybody feels or thinks about, whether they live in the middle of New York City or in the middle of Iowa, to suspend that, because if you don't, then we're setting up more of what we're experiencing right now. We need to let go of those assumptions in order to really make the systemic changes that we need to make and organize in a way that truly does build power and builds a broader base for the changes we want to see, because they're not that different than the changes rural communities want to see.
That was Niaz Dori, Executive Director of the National Family Farm Coalition. We'll hear more from Dori in coming weeks in our coverage of NISAG. That's the Northeast Sustainable Ag Working Group Conference, which took place in Philadelphia. While we're talking about work to do, Dream Defenders co-founder Philip Agnew presented that movement's Freedom Papers, a kind of future-looking update on Thomas Paine, at a recent forum hosted by the SNCC Digital Gateway. That's the new incarnation of the Civil Rights Era Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The Digital Gateway is determined, as they put it, to, quote, learn from the past, organize for the future, and make democracy work. Here's Philip.
There are those that will tell you that corporations magically make this world go around. They'll tell you that businessmen keep the lights on, that they have the power to hire the sun and send it home at night. They'll tell you that bankers are great angels from on high that descend from heavenly penthouses with messages from the bank of God. They'll tell you that hell on earth can all be eased with their credit and cars and clothes. They'll tell you that they saved the day. They'll tell you that the real problem ain't them, that the real problem is your man or your woman or that Haitian or that illegal or that redneck. And if we could just do away with them, we could all do big business better together. But we know better. We know about their eviction letters and rent hikes. We know about their cut hours and unpaid overtime and no insurance. We know about the crumbling schools, their police and prisons, and our empty wallets and refrigerators. We know who really saves the day. So why don't we praise the cook and the cleaner and the cashier? Why don't we praise the busboy, the barback, and the burger broiler? Why don't we praise the waiter, the welder, and the dishwasher? Why don't we praise the maid, mother, and our children and theirs? Why don't we praise the trash man, the last man to stand with King before he became a holiday? We can build a state that refuses to arrest our kids and provides health care to us all. If there's a police department, a liquor store, and a check cashing place on every block, why can't we have a community center? I don't know about y'all, but we're tired of begging for crumbs from the meals that we cook. So we offer these 7 freedoms like lit sticks of dynamite for your expectations, like ultralight beams in the dead of night, pictures of possibility, a new North Star, reminders of our yesterdays and our tomorrows, a new contract between us and our grandchildren. These are our freedom papers. And so what it goes on is it's 7 freedoms: freedom from poverty, freedom from prisons, freedom of mind, a free flourishing democracy, freedom of movement, freedom from war and violence at home and abroad, and a freedom to be. And it lays out a central story that we wanna put out and we wanna collectivize, that the problems of this world are built by corporations. It's a basic story that we all know and that we all understand, but no young people believe at all. They don't believe that if it don't make money, that it's something that they should do, right? It's an activity that they should be engaged in or interested in. And so we've gotta undermine that story. And we've got to really show people that, look, we don't make our decisions based on this money. Right? We don't look at developers like gods who come in and they can make the slums walk again. We look at it differently, and we could put forth that idea and they're ready for that idea. And the closing part I want to read for you all very quickly, and I'll end it, is our version of a poem written by Martine Espada called Imagine the Angels of Bread. This is a year that rent freezes, that no family faces eviction to make way for a new highway or high rise or coffee shop or parking lot. This is the year that governments call emergency sessions, threaten government shutdowns if opponents refuse multi-billion dollar bailouts for single mothers. This is the year 4-time felons found guilty of falling in traps are found running in Miami and running in Pahokee and running in Duval for Senate and mayor and governor. This is the year abuelas and grands made maids, rise at dawn, pack blankets, make meals, board buses to beaches to bathe, bask, and laugh in suns once served under. If our liberation began with the vision of a world without the colony, the slum, favela, and ghetto, then this is the year. So let every one of us, hungry, tired, yet undefeated, lasso a new North Star and study war no more.
Well, that does it for this week's show. If you have worked your heart out this year for a change in Congress or in your state house or in some other way in your community, one thing you know, as we do, that not all the change we need as a nation is ever going to come from Congress, no matter who is in charge. When it comes to the themes of today's program, consent, connection, representation, and the freedom to be, we need serious structural changes of just the sort Thomas Jefferson had in mind, and some he didn't have in mind, when he wrote that governments have a tendency to degenerate. Public rebellions, as he put it, are what nourish attention to the affairs of the public. We've seen rebellions of the right and the left in the last few years. What corrodes the body politic, he'd say, is taking losses or even wins lying down. Blue wave or red wave or purple wave or green, what has kept the United States on track have been waves of people power, organized, accountable, intersectional, rising up, not just to vote, but to put life into our democracy. If you missed our report last time on progressives running for office in rural America, check it out, or our report on transformational cities. All of our archives are at our website. That is www.lauraflanders.org. Now is the time more than ever to support programming like this. We're heading into our year-end fundraising season at the Laura Flanders Show. We're already getting ready to bring you a whole new year of reports on visionaries and rebellious innovations all across the country. And remember, this is the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. So do it. You voted act, resist, revive, and whatever you're doing, stand up for public media like this program. It's what connects us all. It's the glue. We don't take money from governments or corporations. We rely on you. So thank you, and don't forget to tell your friends to check out this show by watching on Lynx TV, Free Speech TV, CUNY, or listening to the Pacifica Radio Network, or subscribing to this podcast. You can write to me, that's Laura, L-A-U-R-A, at lauraflanders.org. I do my best to get back to each and every one of you. And thanks. Till next time, stay kind, stay curious. I'm Laura Flanders.